Wolf, get away from those sheep.
Bollocks.
You're listening to the Wolf and the Shepherd podcast, broadcasting from Fort Worth in the great state of Texas. Now, get ready for this episode of the Wolf and the Shepherd.
Welcome to this episode of the Wolf and the Shepherd. Today we have with us Randall Stroud, who's got a very interesting story to tell. Really interesting guy. Randall, so glad you could take some time out of your day to join us.
It's a pleasure to be here, and I think that we'll have a very interesting conversation for the listeners.
Now, Randall, the biggest compliment I can pay you is that if you actually posted a recipe on a blog online, I would actually read all that crap about your life story before they got to the recipe part. I actually cook a lot.
Oh, is that not the worst part about these recipes online? Seriously, yeah. It's like I just want a different way to smoke ribs on the smoker. Yeah. I don't need to know about your grandfather.
Yeah, I want to make a lasagna, but now I've got to read about your Aunt Betty's cookery.
Yeah. Collection. Where did that come from?
It's like, forget it. I'll just heat up some Hot Pockets. But if you had your life story, Randall, I would actually read it. And my girlfriend asked me today, she goes, who are you interviewing today? And I told her about the first two. And then I told her about you. And she goes, well, tell me something about him. And I just said, no, you're going to have to listen to the podcast. I can't sum this up in a couple of sentences.
You're terrible.
Well, also, I wasn't in the mood for talking. So there was that bit. So, Randall, I think the best part to start with this story is right at the beginning. Normally, we kind of jump into the topic if we have one, but with you, I think you really need to tell this from right from the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, just kind of looking at a little bit, and you know a lot more about the guy than I do, right? Mm-hmm. But I totally agree. You're going to have to walk us through here because you got a fascinating story. So
because otherwise it's going to be like reading the last book in The Lord of the Rings after missing the first and be like, what the bloody hell's going on here?
We're seeing the last Lord of the Rings movie and thinking the movie was over and there's like still an hour and 20 minutes left. Yeah. But no, it's not that bad. Mm. Although I know we have some people that probably like Lord of the Rings, so... It's a good movie, but that last one, I don't know. But anyway, sorry. Randall, take over, man. Tell us about yourself.
Well, it's been a long, strange journey since the very beginning of my existence. Whenever my mom got pregnant, well, actually, before she got pregnant, she was told by doctors that she wasn't able to have children because of endometriosis. And right before she met my father, he was living down in Florida, and he got into a scuffle with these groups of guys, and they ended up hitting him between the legs with a baseball bat. And they said, you're never going to have children either. So about a year after that happened, he came to Tennessee and ended up meeting my mother, and they both got together, and they both shared their stories. I can't have children. You can't have children. They bonded over that. And he ended up getting her pregnant within a couple of months. And that's how my older brother was born. And then a few years later, he get her pregnant again. But this time her stomach was huge. And the technology wasn't that good back in the 80s. And the doctors said, well, we hear a heartbeat. Your baby seems healthy, but your stomach is huge. You have too much water in there, too much fluid retention. Maybe we can give you some medication to shrink that down. And my grandfather, my father's father, he says, don't take those pills. Do not take those pills because it's going to kill your other child that's in there. The doctors are laughing. They're like, sir, we're trained professionals. There's only one child in there. And he tells my mother, you know, if you take these pills, you're not my daughter-in-law anymore. She said, okay, whatever. Delivery day comes and they pull out my sister. And then the doctor says, oh, there is another baby in here. And my mom is, you know, laying on the delivery table. And the doctor, as she tells me, was quite a jokester. And she thought he was just kidding around. And he's like, no, I'm serious. There's another kid in here. And he pulls me out. And they only knew about my sister. So my dad had a pink room that was designed. Everything was ready for my sister. And then he already has a hold of my sister. Then the doctor is like, do you want to see your son? And he's like, oh, I think you're talking about the room next door. And they're like, no, there's another kid in here. You have a son. You have twins. And so he had to go rush to the store and get, you know, more stuff for me. I mean, so from the very beginning, my sort of birth was predestined that, you know, this child was going to be different from my other children. And that's sort of how the saga began. And growing up, having an older brother and a twin sister, they were very typical. You know, they went out with their friends, did their thing. At the age of five, I'm picking up leaves and I'm contemplating, how did this thing get here? Why is it green? I used to ask my mom all these questions. Why? And she says, will you ever stop asking why? So I even wrote a book. It's called Why, the Greatest Question Ever Asked. Because if you don't ask why, you don't figure out how things came to be. And if you don't know how things came to be, you're bound to repeat it. So I'm obsessed with that question, why? Because if you don't know why something is happening, you also don't know how to fix it. And like when it comes to politics and marital problems, all kinds of things, people are obsessed with the solution, but not the why. Or when you wake up in the morning, if you don't have a why, then you're just working to pay bills. You know, so why is a very important motivator in life. So yeah, life goes on. And, you know, growing up as a kid, I was always a little bit of a late bloomer, as you'll say, while everyone's sort of doing this, it took me a little longer to catch up because I'm so contemplative. I move slower, but I tend to go further. I don't think I hit puberty until I was like 17. It's like my senior year in high school. I looked like a kid all throughout school. And then once I hit 17, I'm 6 feet tall and have a mustache. I'm like, great, my senior year in school, I'm finally handsome, but it's time to go.
So how old are you now, Randall? Because I'll be honest with you, mate, you look about 23, 24.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm 34.
34? All right, that's still pretty young compared to us. So
yeah, we'll go with that. We're old men.
Now, was your dad actually pretty happy he had a son? Because, you know, let's get the misogyny out the way early. Because when his firstborn was a daughter, and he was a bit like communist China. He wanted to send it back and swap it for a boy. But was your dad pretty happy that, you know, he had a boy as well as a girl coming?
My dad, just like everybody, he has his flaws. He's a flawed guy. But one thing that I can say about him is he absolutely loves kids. Doesn't matter if it's boy, girl. Even to this day, if he sees a kid, even if it's not his own, and he sees like a struggling single mom or whoever, I mean, he's literally the type of guy, hey, here's $100 or let me buy this kid a toy. You know, so he absolutely loves kids, you know, roughhousing with them, playing with them. He's definitely, a lover of children.
Right. No, totally makes sense. So let's kind of get into the meat of why your story is kind of so interesting. And honestly, there's so many aspects of this story that we can talk about. So let's get the politics out of the way first, right? So you're a former political candidate. Walk us through that. What office did you run for? Why'd you run for that office? All that good stuff.
Well, my political journeys sort of started, I guess, around 2012. You know, I got into political activism, checking out different protests and things like that. But I want to say like around 2010, and this is sort of the backdrop into that. Like I said, I've always been a truth seeker, a very curious person, you know, and I wanted to be a lawyer for a long time growing up in my life because I was good at arguments, bringing up facts, investigating things. But I didn't come from the best family or the best neighborhood. You know, got into fights a lot as a kid. That's why I got into martial arts and different things. My first career, I actually wanted to be a professional kickboxer, but things interrupted that. But around 2010, I was like, you know, I'm never going to become this kickboxer or whatever. And I ended up getting a traffic ticket. And I was supposedly not wearing my seatbelt, but I was. And I went to a law library. And within a few weeks, I taught myself how to write legal motions. And I ended up going to court and winning the case and getting it dismissed. And the reason why I got into martial arts is because I was kind of a scrawny kid in a bad neighborhood. And I was obsessed with learning how to defend myself. And I did successfully sometimes. Sometimes I would get beat up. But I had this eureka moment. I said, wow, I can use knowledge and I can use the pen, truly can be mightier than the sword. So for a couple of years, I was obsessed with, you know, studying how to write legal motions and doing discovery requests and all these things. I was even helping some friends and families like with their traffic tickets, or someone went through a divorce, whatever it was. And I really knew my stuff. And I started getting a lot of attention from the courts, from, you know, just local leaders and different people. And then people were like, hey, if you're not going to become a lawyer, you know, maybe you should become a paralegal. So I got involved in doing legal research for a lot of human rights cases, discrimination cases for, you know, employment, different things, just all kinds of different things, you know, wrote books. I mean, I can go on and on and on, but now getting into the political side, running for political office. So around 2018, I'd written all these books. I did all these human rights cases, all these things. And I was like, you know what? I think it's time for me to step up and have some actual authority. I don't have the money to run for president. I don't even have the money to run for governor or anything. I need to start small, but not too small. I don't want to be on a school board, but I was looking at different offices that were opened up, and it was for a state representative position. So they do state law. And I went to this political meeting. I think it was like the Libertarian Party of Tennessee or something like that. I noticed that they were having a meeting that was near where I was staying at the time. And they were serving free food. So I was like, okay, I'll go check it out. And I was flirting with the idea of running for office. And I went and I saw a couple of people that I recognized. And we were just talking about all kinds of issues like healthcare, you know, family law, since I was working in family law as a paralegal at the time, just all kinds of issues. And I had something interesting to add to the conversation for all these different areas. And one of my friends was like, dude, you should run for office, because I don't agree with everything that you say, but you're very articulate and you're very thoughtful on your approaches. So you should totally run for office. And even if you lose, it'll look good on your resume. And I was like, I don't know, man. And he sends me the requirements. He's like, well, all you need is 50 signatures from registered voters to run for office. Just get the signatures and just get on the ballot. And just for, you know, shits and giggles, your name will be on the ballot and maybe you'll get a, you know, a handful of votes. And I was like, all right, man, so I'll do it. So I basically did it on a dare. Me and a friend, his name's David Bunn. He ended up becoming my campaign manager. So shout out to him. He's a really great guy. He's helped me a lot. We went door to door, knocked on some doors and got some people to sign, got on the ballot. And I was like, okay, I did my duty. I'm on the ballot. Told a couple of friends and family members, like, hey, just relax, go vote for me if you don't like the other guy. And the guy I ran against was Bill Beck. He was an incumbent Democrat. He's still in office to this day. And no one dared run against him because he's like a multimillionaire, super rich guy. He pretty much has this district on lock. Nobody's going to beat him. Nobody had ran against him, you know, in years. So once I get on the official ballot, you know, all these news media outlets are releasing names like, okay, you know, this person in this district is running against this person, all those basic formalities. Well, a couple weeks go by, I start getting phone calls from the Tennessean newspaper, different media outlets. I'm getting things in the mail asking me to fill out questionnaires. How do you feel about the tax code? How do you feel about feminism? How do you feel about abortion? You know, I'm filling these things out and sending them back, and I keep getting more and more responses. And then it dawned on me, I was like, oh, I'm actively campaigning and I'm engaging. This isn't a joke anymore. I'm actually doing this. And it was a really good experience, but there were some bumps in the road. Like, for example, on the campaign trail, I had these yard signs. You know, every candidate has a yard sign. You know, if you're driving through a neighborhood, you'll see, you know, Trump 2020 or Biden 2020, whatever. So, you know, I'm bringing my marketing campaign together and I'm like, we need yard signs. And I got a really good deal. It was like a couple hundred bucks, and I got like over 1,000 of them. And I'm really excited. Randall Stroud 2020, vote loud, vote Stroud, you know, coming up with these slogans. And I'm putting them in people's yards. I'm talking to people. I'm going to events, giving speeches, doing all these things. And I'm really excited. I'm driving through the city, and I'm seeing people with my yard sign, and I'm feeling very proud of myself. And then I start getting these phone calls, and they're like, you know, you're in danger of being fined by the Federal Election Commission, right? I'm like, for what? Well, you didn't put on
campaign
there.
Campaign finance. I know where this is going. Yeah.
Paid for by the Randall Stroud Association, right. so on and so
treasurer. Yeah, you got to do that.
Exactly. And see, I didn't know these rules because, you know, after I got my name on the ballot, I just thought, okay, it's a done deal. And then come to find out, too, every quarter I have to fill out all this paperwork. If I got any donations, I have to release their names and information. I'm like, wow, this is an actual lot of work. And I have to assign a treasurer and a campaign manager, all this stuff. And so the first couple of months, there was a lot of setbacks where just administratively I was learning the ropes because I didn't have a consultant behind me. I sort of just fell into this for laughs, and now it was turning into this serious thing. And I was like, well, I don't have the money because I'm like, you know, we were on a shoestring budget. This entire campaign, we spent less than $2,000. And I didn't have the money to go out and just buy a bunch of new yard signs and go to every house and say, hey, I need you to remove your sign and put this here. So my campaign manager, David, he's like, well, I have a box of Sharpie markers. Let's go to every sign that we put out there and physically write it on there. And we did, you know, so we just driving all around town with Sharpie markers, just, you know, adding that message on the bottom, you know, paid for by Randall Stroud campaign and putting all that on there. And the Federal Election Commission, I think they sent some field investigator or something like that. And he went around and, you know, looked at it and you know, he was satisfied and he was like, that was very creative of you. Good job. Disaster averted.
Yeah. No, I totally understand that. I remember back when I was in college, I actually campaigned for like a county commissioner. I don't even remember who it was. And guy ended up winning. And all I did was stand outside the polling place with a sign. And there was this couple, a married couple, and the guy was running for some other, you know, political office, something like that, right? And it turned out when they went in to vote, that guy's name was the last name on the ballot. So I jokingly was kind of hanging out with them. I said, you know, a good little sign you could put up as people are pulling into the polling place, because it was literally, if you were going to vote for this guy, it was that district. This was the only place to vote, and that's why they were focusing their campaign stuff. I said, you ought to just say, hey, vote for whoever it was, can't remember the guy's name, the last name on the ballot. And they both looked at me like, that's genius. So the wife runs to the store and buys a poster board and then draws on the poster board, vote for whomever the last name on the ballot, and is holding it up. And the guy said, oh, we've got to put paid for by blah, blah, blah. And she said, oh, that's right. And, you know, and she takes it and literally writes it down on there. And it's kind of ironic if you think about, you know, we've talked about several times on the podcast before about, you know, political corruption, all this stuff. But then somebody runs out to you trying to run for state representative and you forget to put that on the sign. So long kind of explanation to ask you this next question, because I had to get that out there. Jim something. His name was Jim. I'm gonna get that name here in a little bit, the guy I campaigned for. But anyway, so in that whole deal that you did, right, and trying to run for office, and you're running essentially third party. So you said, you know, you're in Tennessee, the Democrat is the incumbent, no Republican's going to run against. So essentially you're third party, even though there's only two parties running, What did you learn about the political system in trying to run for office against somebody like that?
Well, at the time, the Libertarian Party, they were interested in me because they liked some of my positions, because at the time I was talking about a lot of issues that other candidates weren't talking about. I mean, taxes and abortion, you know, guns, those things get done to death. But I was talking about issues like divorce laws, you know, father's rights and things like this, and why it's so expensive for divorcing couples to get, you know, shared parenting and these kind of things. And I was talking about adoption. Why is it so expensive to adopt a child? And we have to go to a different country just to be able to afford to adopt a child. And we have so many here, just little pet issues like that. But, you know, the Libertarian Party, we ended up having some differences. But even with them, they had their presidential candidate. And in order for them to get on the ballot, they needed something like 100,000 signatures from registered voters, and then they had to have, you know, certain amount of money in their campaign chest. I mean, the Democrats and Republicans just have a huge monopoly on the political system. And then too, even with running, you know, for office, if you don't have a consultant, if you don't have some expensive lawyer behind you, it's easy to make a lot of mistakes. Like, even when I got on the ballot, you have the main election cycle, but then you have early voting. Well, during early voting, I apparently didn't fill out some form and my name wasn't on the early voting ballots. And some people didn't see my name, so they voted for whoever was on there. And let's be honest, the two-party system, it makes it so easy for us to say, well, I'm a D or an R. And then, you know, whenever you go to the ballot, you just put D or you just put R. And you don't look at the individual person. And another thing that I noticed was when I was running for office, all the doors that I knocked on, all the people that I talked to, it would be so hilarious, you know, just coming from a private investigative or, you know, paralegal background, you know, researching and digging into people. If you talk to someone, they're like, yeah, I'm a hardline conservative Republican, or I'm a strict liberal Democrat. If you kind of crack that shell and you start conversing more and more and you just ask questions and just listen, well, what do you think about this issue? Well, I feel this way. Well, what about in this situation? Well, maybe not. When you really dig into somebody, people are a lot more nuanced than D and R. You know, people ask me all the time, are you a Democrat or a Republican? Are you conservative or liberal? And I'm like, that's like asking me, are you winter or summer? Well, what about spring and fall? Are you black or white? What about gray and onyx? I mean, there's all these hues in between that just get totally pushed to the wayside. Now, even whenever we think about George Washington in his farewell address, he warned us that this would happen. He said, with the creation of political parties, it will create a cycle of revenge. And that's exactly what we have now. Is whenever Trump was in office, the Democrats do everything they can. Let's sue him. Let's do articles of impeachment. This, you know, whatever it takes to make sure that he's not successful or he enjoys success. And now that we have Biden, the same things happen. And the Republicans are like, oh, we got to find reasons to impeach him. And anything that he does good, we can't give him credit for it. And you're kind of forced into this this tribalism. And you know, I noticed that, and I felt like I broke a lot of barriers being an independent candidate. People would ask me, you know, are you Democrat or Republican? And I'm like, well, let's have a conversation. And that almost never happens when you identify as a Democrat or Republican, because people, they sum you up. And so it was just really fun having conversations with people and discussing solutions instead of wasting all this time about who's the enemy, the Democrats or Republicans, and then solutions aren't being discussed.
Yeah, I think people mistakenly say that politics today is too infiltrated with identity politics. But the truth is, we went from one form of identity politics to another, because maybe 20, 25 years ago, regardless of which party you represented, you had to check certain boxes. You had to be a Christian. You had to love America.
You had to have a loud truck that just drove by and got picked up in the microphones.
Well, it's Texas. So it's part and parcel of living in Texas. It doesn't matter what you do. There's going to be a loud truck in the background, regardless of what time you record. So, but identity politics has already been there. But the last probably 10, 15 years, it drifted more into the partisan identity away from the personality identity, to the point where it's almost irrespective of what you believe. It's the only important thing is that D or R next to your name. And we were talking to a doctor earlier, and I made the point, which I've mentioned before, that, you know, Chris Rock said politics has turned into tribalism. It's basically now gangs whereby people make their mind up who they're going to support based upon that D or R, not the words that comes out of their mouth or the actions. It's like, well, if you say this because you have a D next to your name, I agree with it, and I'm going to support that position. Regardless, if you asked me and there was no politics involved, I might take the opposite viewpoint. But because you've got a D next to your name, I'm going to agree with you. So the personality part of politics has almost disappeared, because whereas before you had to be squeaky clean, I mean, if you go back again to that George Washington, you know, I cannot tell a lie thing. I mean, that's probably, that would be the biggest joke in politics if anybody actually came out and said that nowadays. You know, like the personality part of it, they don't expect you to be squeaky clean. They don't expect you to always tell the truth. You know, if you've been married before, if you've got kids out of wedlock, they really don't care anymore. The most important thing is if you have that D or that R next to your name. So it's almost like you don't have to fight as hard as you used to convince people to vote for you. It's more a case of you're guaranteed a certain number of votes because of what that letter is before your name. And then you have a certain centrist level of people where, like you were saying, you know, you had the opportunity to have that nuance and have conversations with people. But it seems that number of people seems to be shrinking, because people have always got already got the identity out of the way even before the candidates are revealed.
Well, and I'll tell you this as well. When I ran against Bill Beck, since he was, you know, this Democratic incumbent, and I was living in a very liberal district, even though Tennessee is a conservative state as a whole, there are very liberal districts as well. So certain people that I knew that were in the Republican Party, I have friends that are lobbyists with like Americans for Prosperity and some of those lobbying groups for tax reform and stuff. You know, I have friends from both sides of the political aisle. And some of them reached out to me and was like, hey, welcome to the Republican Party. You know, come to us. We'll help you beat Bill Beck. Because I do lean, I think, more conservative, but I'm still very much a free thinker. I'm very, you know, I'm willing to mitigate things, to get things done. But I noticed that the Republican Party were like, well, you know, you can join us, but you can't say this, you can't believe in this, and you can't do this, you can't do this. So I didn't feel like, by doing that, even though they were tempting me with all these gifts, yeah, we'll fund your commercials and you know, we'll throw all this money at you and help you really get out there, I felt like I wasn't running as Randall Stroud anymore. I was just running as the Republican Party with Randall Stroud sort of pinned on to it. And that's not what I was about. I had a unique message. I was running for issues and mentioning issues that a lot of people felt like just weren't being discussed. I mean, Donald Trump, Joe Biden, you know, none of these guys talk about adoption reform or marriage reform. I mean, the divorce laws that we have right now are still based on things that were going on in the 1950s and 60s. You know, women don't work and my husband ran off with a secretary, you know, and it's just not like that anymore. Or just, you know, other issues like marijuana, for example. I myself don't partake, but I do think that, especially for medical reasons, you know, people should have the right to, you know, choose if they want to intake that in their body with reasonable regulations, of course, you know, being old enough and things. And I was just talking about a lot of issues, and I never shied away from any question. No matter what people asked me, we would talk about it. Whereas, you know, the other politicians were like, well, you know, divert that to my campaign manager. And we, we just don't have opportunities for, you know, other voices to get on that, that main stage or that main platform, and they're going to keep it that way.
Yeah, that makes total sense. So let's back up a little bit, and maybe I got the timeline wrong. You mentioned you wrote a lot of books. Let's talk about some of the books that you wrote there in the past, kind of just before your political campaign, and what you were writing about.
Well, before I even got in politics, I got involved in politics and political activism and these, you know, different kinds of things. I want to say around 2012. But before that, I was very much interested in theology and in martial arts, you know, which those things are actually very closely related. You know, if you go all throughout, you know, Asia, China, and even wrestlers and boxers throughout Greece and all these places, they combined, you know, athletics with theology. You know, there was this, you know, philosophy behind it. And growing up in a rough neighborhood, I was a white kid in a mostly black slash Asian sort of neighborhood, a lot of Cambodian immigrants. I stood out like a sore thumb, and people would, you know, challenge you. So up until about 2011, 2010, I thought I was going to be this, you know, boxer or kickboxer, you know, or martial arts instructor. And that's sort of what I was focusing on, because I felt like I had to learn how to protect myself and everybody was out to get me. That was sort of my mindset up until 2010, because I graduated from high school in 05, and it took a couple of years to shake off some of the things that I saw going to school, you know, people getting shot, you know, students beating up teachers. I mean, it was really horrendous. I would even skip school sometimes and walk to the library and read books because I was, you know, very, very dedicated towards my own education. So I always had this sort of, you know, self-made sort of thing that even if I couldn't make it into college, you know, even if I couldn't do anything, I could create it myself, because we live in the information age. There's no excuse. If you can afford a cell phone, you have the world's knowledge in your hands. So at that time, I was going to be this great fighter. But then around 2009 or 10, I went to a competition in Kentucky, and I ended up dislocating my shoulder. The guy, it was funny because on the way to the event, someone stole the truck that was supposed to put the mats on the floor, and we were fighting on a basketball court. And you can find that video on YouTube somewhere. And I'm fighting this guy on a basketball court. And, you know, it's real good back and forth for a couple of minutes there. And then he ends up like picking me up and throwing me to the ground pretty hard. And like, I dislocated my shoulder, and I tried to put it back in and, you know, throw a punch, and it just fell right back out. It's pretty nasty stuff. But after that happened, you know, I was like, well, there goes my fighting career. I even had a doctor tell me, you're never going to throw a punch again without my $30,000 surgery. And I ended up doing some experimental procedure, getting some stem cells injected in there, and it healed up, you know, perfectly. I never had to get any sort of surgery or nothing like that. And I'm still good to this day. But that took about a year of recovery. But and then during that year, I was doing a lot of, you know, soul searching. And that was the year that I got that traffic ticket where the officer pulled me over. He was a real jerk. He pulled me over, and as I pulled over, I took off my seatbelt. I was very respectful, and it was in some small town. Like, you know how some of these small town cops are, that they don't have a lot to do. And yeah, so he wrote that ticket, and it was like $60. I was like, what, for a seatbelt ticket? Like, are you kidding me? If it was like $20, I probably just would have paid it and you know, didn't care. But I've always had this really strong sense of justice and fairness and all these kind of things. And that's when I went to the law library, taught myself how to write a motion. And that's when I had that epiphany that, you know, I don't have to go around like this all the time to protect myself. There's other ways that you can do it. And that's sort of when I had my enlightening moment. So I wrote my first book in, I think, 2011, and it was just all about martial arts. Some of my life experiences, you know, getting in the ring and fighting. I mean, that could be a whole podcast in and of itself. And I didn't get into politics. I didn't run for office until 2018. So that's 8 years. So between that time and 2018, I still practice martial arts. I still, you know, train a few people here and there. But from 2011 to 2018, 19, I was doing all kinds of political stuff, you know, and I wrote books about family law. I wrote books about, you know, what are some other books that I wrote on philosophy? Because there were times where I ended up homeless, you know, like losing my job, series of unfortunate incidences. So I wrote about just surviving life and being on the streets. One of my books was called The Ninja Mindset, which was all about that. And, you know, being on the streets for a while, living that kind of lifestyle, you learn and pick up certain things like, oh, if I'm in a small town, I get noticed by the police more. But if I'm in a big city, nobody pays attention. I mean, honestly, I'm the type of guy where I feel like in my 34 years on this earth, I've lived about 10 lives.
Yeah.
You know,
now I did a mixed martial arts full contact from about, I think, 16 through about 22, 23. And there's a lot of misconceptions about martial arts and boxing.
Definitely.
Because people feel that, oh, it's a great outlet for aggression. But in reality, when you do martial arts, it's the most constrictive practice or discipline you can imagine, because you really have to learn to control your emotions, have mind over matter in terms of, you know, overcoming that fight flight type reaction within you. Because, you know, a lot of raw fighters, new fighters, they feel if they're very aggressive and very fast, it will get the job done. You know, it takes a while to learn that being patient and learning about your opponent is the best strategy. I think Mike Tyson came up with that quote about everybody has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. And that's one thing I kind of learned, you know, with martial arts, is that, you know, you have all these thoughts running through your head when you're up against an opponent, you know, you size them up. If you've had a chance, you'll see, you know, how they fought in their previous fights, especially with tournaments, all day tournaments and stuff. But, you know, one thing I had to learn was to actually be less aggressive and be more mindful and be more selective about my moments of attack, and really understand that, you know, this isn't about physicality. This is about control of self, control of mind. And it doesn't matter how big or strong or powerful I am. I can lose a fight to somebody, you know, a quarter of my size if I don't have the correct mindset and discipline. And so that was a kind of a big surprise to me, because I'd done boxing before that. A lot of my family members were in boxing, and, you know, I did 2 or 3 fights. Wasn't really that enamored with it.
Oh, cool.
And a friend, you know, got involved with Wataru karate, and then an offshoot like Shotokan karate, and then Tai Chi. And I finally jumped in and went to a few of these different classes, and we actually ended up going to a mixed martial arts and Brazilian jiu-jitsu dojo. And we, like I said, we were there for about 5-6 years. We fought in various regional and national competitions. But yeah, it's a completely different environment than you think. It's not a place for people to go and get aggression out of their system. It really is a very introspective and existential environment.
Oh, most definitely. If it wasn't for martial arts and boxing as well, absolutely love boxing. If it wasn't for those experiences, I wouldn't be here right now. You know, that is what has allowed me to survive up until this point. I always tell people that anything that I've experienced, you know, just in my personal life, there's a metaphor for it that I've already learned through martial arts or being in a boxing ring. You know, like, for example, like even in dating, for example, when you go on a date with a girl, you don't just walk up and say, hey, you're beautiful, marry me. You know, same thing in a fight. You have to measure your opponent. You have to look, analyze, see what the weak points are and the strong points, and then you go in accordingly. So for every situation that I found myself in life, I would revert it back to a situation that I had while I was sparring or while I was, you know, doing some sort of practice. And I really think that, especially in today's time, where, and this might be a controversial statement, but because now 1 in 4 families grow up without a father, you know, like fatherlessness is a huge issue right now in the modern world. You know, over 70% of people in prison right now, they admit, you know, they fill out the surveys and they say, I've never met my father, or I have a strained relationship with my father. And there's a lot of young guys out there that learn about masculinity and learn about chivalry and all these kind of things through the martial arts and through boxing, because historically being a martial artist was kind of like being a knight. You know, you learned about chivalry, you had these code of honor and ethics and all these kind of things. And like I said, 1 in 4 children grow up without a father now in the United States, and martial arts and boxing, it's not a substitute for a father, but you know, my parents divorced when I was 13 and then he became absent for about 10 years. It was martial arts and boxing that taught me those skills of how to lay on the ropes and just get beat up, but still learn how to defend myself and block, and then look into the future and say, okay, where's my opportunity to strike? That's a life lesson.
Yeah, I think it does transfer into various aspects of life, that discipline, because there is, you know, this temptation when you see a weak point, throw all your energy and hit in that weak point. But sometimes you need to learn that even consistent small pressure does just as much damage as trying to land one big hit on somebody. But, you know, with respect to what you were saying about kids growing up without fathers, in every, pretty much every mammal, you know, rough play between, you know, the males within the family is very significant in terms of growth, both from a, you know, physiological point of view, you know, animals learning how to fight and defend, but also from a psychological point of view, that they get that aggression out of their system, or rather it's controlled in a controlled environment. And so whatever kind of like hormones, endorphins get released under certain situations, instead of those taking control of you, you do get to be able to exercise that mind over matter and be able to focus on being level-headed and approach a situation which, without that type of discipline, you know, might lead to more erratic behavior, like outbursts of violence, rather than deciding, you know, reason is the best policy in this.
Well, another huge lesson that you learn from martial arts and boxing is learning to accept defeat. And that's something that's not being encouraged in society right now, where we sort of live in this participation trophy society where we have to coddle everyone and we have to make sure that no one feels left out. And there are some legitimate points to be made about that. But I remember the first time I went to a boxing gym, I came from a background of doing like karate and taekwondo and doing some wrestling. You know, my older brother was also involved in various martial arts, so, you know, I learned some stuff from him too. But the first time I went to a boxing gym, I remember going in there thinking that, oh, I already had all this experience from other martial arts, I'm going to come in here and it's going to be a breeze. And I get into the ring with this kid who's like a couple of years younger than me. And then they're like, well, this is boxing, so, you know, you can't kick and do these other things, you have to do this sport. And I'm like, okay, fine, whatever. And this kid just, you know, beats me up and I get humbled. And I think that everyone should experience getting their ass kicked at least once in their life, because especially guys, everyone thinks that they're better than what they really are until they get into that situation. I can't tell you how many times I've gone to bars and hung out with friends who've never been in a fight in their whole life. And they're like, oh, he needs to jab more. Or if I was in there, I would be throwing this punch. I'm like, no, you wouldn't. You'd be tired in 10 seconds. So the point that I'm trying to make is, I think that especially boxing, wrestling, combat sports are wonderful, because a lot of parents who are maybe hesitant to get their kids into boxing or wrestling, karate, whatever, they're hesitant, thinking that's going to make them a more violent person. Maybe initially, because I got into it, my initial motivations was I want to learn how to kick some ass. But you are going to get beat up. You are going to get humbled. And you're going to come across a fellow student, if not your own coach, who's going to slap you down and show you that, hey, there's always someone bigger, better, stronger, faster than you. And those heartbreaks of getting, I remember the first time that I actually sparred and put on equipment, you know, when I was like, I don't know, I really got heavy into martial arts like around 11. And I remember getting just really beat up pretty bad for the first time. And I almost wanted to cry, but it's those heartbreaks that you get from sparring and all these kind of things that prepare you for future heartbreaks in life, whether it's a, you know, breaking up with a woman or losing a job or whatever it is. As a kid, when you put them in this situation where they have to hold their hands up and take damage and learn to stay composed in the middle of that chaos, that carries with you all throughout life. So anytime that I find myself in the middle of a romantic breakup, or maybe I'm having financial problems or whatever it is, I say, oh, this is just a bad round for me. I'll have a good round next time. And then if you wait it out, if you ride that wave of turbulence and you cover up, eventually life gets tired and then you have an opening to do better for yourself.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent way to look at it, actually. So transitioning to one of the next parts about your life, I wanted to be the one to ask this question. You've been shot in the head. Take us through that story, but as you take us through that story, make sure and tell us, like, what does it feel like to be shot in the head?
Well, just like everything, every time that you ask me a question, there's always a backdrop. There's always a lead up to it. So this happened, you know, about a year ago now. So as I was saying earlier, growing up, I was always very, I guess you could say, philosophically or spiritually curious. You know, my mom made me go to church all the time through martial arts. I got curious about Buddhism, Taoism, all these other sort of philosophies. I'd always been really curious about, you know, about God and morality and living this very disciplined life. I mean, I didn't even start dating women until I was 19 because I had a job. I got my first job when I was, you know, 16. I went to school and I was training and doing boxing and martial arts. I didn't have time for a girlfriend. When my parents divorced, I was helping my mom pay bills. I had zero time for a girlfriend. It wasn't until I injured my shoulder that I had time to date for the first time. But and this is leading up to your question, I promise. I'm not sidetracking here. But I lived a very clean life. And by clean, I mean like no drinking, no like casual dating with, you know, women and, you know, just this hyper focused sort of clean moral lifestyle. But around the age of 26, 27, I really just got kind of tired. And I was looking at all my friends who were traveling and, you know, bragging about, you know, dating all these different women and just, you know, partying every weekend. And I was always this kind of guy that, you know, went to the gym twice a day and I was going to church and volunteering and doing this. And I started to feel kind of resentful. And I was like, you know, I kind of want to live that lifestyle. So for a couple of years, man, I sort of got away from myself and I started going to the bars on the weekends and I started traveling and, you know, getting into some scuffles and just having that sort of wild life. But then about a little over a year ago, I met up with some friends. One of my buddies, he owns a comedy store, and I was sort of getting into stand-up comedy and just trying it out. I love being in front of a crowd and expressing myself. And I hadn't seen him in a while, and I just moved back to Nashville. And he invited me to go on the town and, you know, get something to eat, hang out. And we did. We hung out. We walked around town and it started getting late. You know, we'd had some beers and some good food in our bellies. And it was like around 12:30 at night. I said, dude, I got to get home. My car's parked like a mile and a half away from here. I got to start walking. And he says, all right, man, I'll walk with you. So as I'm walking back to my car, we get on this street. It's right off Broadway and 2nd Avenue for anybody who's in Nashville or from Nashville that they know that area. It's like the hot spot in Nashville. It's like where all the bars are. It's where all the action is. So I'm on Broadway and I get off on Second Avenue and I'm walking and there's like this crowd of people. And there's these three guys, they're holding Bibles and they have this huge sign and there's like all this commotion. And I'm like, what's going on here? So I walk up and I start listening and it's these guys who belong to this group. They call themselves the Black Hebrew Israelites. And they say that white people and Asians can't go to heaven and that they're the real Jews. And the crowd that's around them is very sympathetic to them. They're like, yeah, that's right. That's right. And I'm like, this sounds kind of crazy because I grew up in the church, even though I'd been sort of living this sort of crazy sinful lifestyle for a couple of years, you know, partying and whatnot. My upbringing started to reveal itself. You know, there's this Bible verse that says that if you train a child in the way that he shall go, he's less likely to turn away from it. So if you train a child in a certain way, even if they kind of veer away from it, remnants of it are going to stick with them, whether it's good or bad. And I think that growing up in the church, I had good pastors and things, and they instilled a lot of good values in me. But all those Bible studies started coming out in me. So I walk up and I'm disagreeing with these guys. I'm like, that's not right, you know, and we're trading Bible verses. And you know, one of the guys ends up, you know, walking away. So now it's two of them. It's me and my friend who's with me. And but my friend that's with me, he's kind of staying quiet, you know, and he's kind of scared because it's starting to get heated. And this guy is like, you know, we're good. We're getting into heaven. You know, you're not. And I said, you're good. Well, what about Mark chapter 10, where Jesus himself says, none are good but God. And as soon as I said that, as soon as I finished that statement, gunshots started going off in the crowd. And the first bullet that went off came and it didn't hit me directly, but it scraped the back of my head. And I felt this intense burning heat and pressure. And it kind of felt like a paper cut times 100, you know. But I definitely knew that something hit my head. And I kind of just instinctively went down. And like I said earlier, they were holding this sign and it had all these hateful messages written on it saying, like, you know, these are the races that can get into heaven. And that bullet that scraped the back of my head, I look up and it hit their sign and put a big bullet hole in the front of it. And they ran. I ran. It was pandemonium. There were people going everywhere. My adrenaline was just pumping. And I just, you know, I had to get away from that area. I don't know how bad the damage is. I'm not even thinking about it. I just know that I'm alive. And I'm, you know, I'm running and running and running. And my friend who was next to me, he had already left. I kind of skipped over this part, but he had already left because he, you know, he was an African-American just like these guys. And they looked at him and started shaming him for hanging out with me. They were like, you're hanging out with this white guy, you know? And he got kind of, I guess, scared. And he was like, hey, man, I'm going to go. So he left me there by myself. And our friendship ended up sort of getting on the rocks after that for obvious reasons, but that's a whole separate story. Anyways, getting back on track, I'm running and I get to this, this sub shop. I think it was called like King's Subs or something. And it was like these, you know, it was like a Muslim owned business. And I go in there and everyone's just kind of calmly eating. And I run in there like a madman. And I'm like, I've been shot. They're shooting people. And everyone's kind of looking at me like I'm crazy. And the owner comes around and he hands me a soda and he's like, calm down, my brother, sit down. What's going on? And I was like, I've been shot. I don't know how bad it is, but I know I've been shot in the back of my head because I felt this pressure. And then he turns around and looks and he's like, oh yeah, there's blood. And I go like this and I look at my hand and yeah, there's blood on my fingers. And I had, you know, a little bit longer hair that was sort of like combed over. And he was like, well, just wait on the ambulance. And they ended up calling an ambulance and everything. And the police showed up and EMT showed up. They cleaned off my head really good and had a flashlight. And the EMT said, well, good news. It's just a flesh wound. You'll be okay. I don't even think it needs stitches. You're good to go. And the police officer said, I hope you realize that, you know, you're a walking miracle. You're lucky to be alive right now. And I ended up going to my mother's house that night because at the time I was moving from Smyrna, Tennessee, which is about an hour away. And I was in town moving some things. And I just went to her house and I woke her up in the middle of the night and told her what happened. And yeah, just I went to sleep that night. I was emotionally tired. But yeah, after that happened, there was a lot of changes that started happening in my heart and my head. And it was definitely life changing.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that you didn't date till you're 19, but yours sounds kind of deliberate. I didn't date till 19, but that's because I was really crap with girls. But what one thing I did have in common with you is that, you know, I was into philosophy at quite a young age. You know, I'd read a lot of poetry, a lot of classical poetry, a lot of classical literature, and try and find, you know, what they were really trying to say, or at least how it applied to me. But I think I went through a period of life where I think a lot of young people do when they start drinking and partying, where they try and live, I don't know, their vision of what life should be like, what they're told should make them happy. And a huge proportion of people fall away from this and actually end up regretting wasting their lives doing the drinking and the partying.
Oh, yeah.
What do you think it is in young people that stops, I guess, introspection and looking at how they're living their lives, and they seem to all follow this carbon copy lifestyle, which all seems to lead to the same conclusion for the majority of people? Because if the definition of insanity is repeating the same thing over and over again and expecting different results, we've certainly got a pattern in our culture that repeats that same lifestyle and repeats those same mistakes you know, throughout. And you look at some of the other cultures in the world, and especially with regard to martial arts, you know, a lot of kids in Asia, you know, you take Japan, etc., don't kind of grow up and go through those type of stages we do. You know, they're taught, I think, maturity and consequences for actions at a earlier age, whereas here there doesn't seem to be any type of cause and effect teaching. You're expected to learn from your mistakes up front. I mean, nobody ever said to me, look, don't get into the drinking and partying lifestyle. You know, it'll wreck your life. You'll make some mistakes. You'll regret some things you say or do for the rest of your life. But nobody, you know, even hinted at that type of thing. And I don't know anybody was given that advice, not even from your parents. They might say, oh, be safe. But it's like we're allowed this mess up period in our life from high school through the end of the college and sometimes, you know, through the late 20s, where that's your proving ground, whether you either screw up or make it as a person, and then you go on from there. But why do you think philosophy as such isn't really taught to any depth in schools, when in reality it's probably the most prominent and important thing for somebody to find out who they are and what their direction should be in life? And yet it's almost in Western civilization completely ignored to a point.
Well, that's a very loaded question. With it can go in a lot of directions, but I'm a very cultured guy. You know, like I said, I grew up in a community with a lot of different races. You know, at one point I was studying to be a Buddhist monk, believe it or not. I had a lot of Cambodian friends. I've dated, you know, girls from other countries, from, you know, Korea, the Philippines. And it absolutely is, it's not specifically a Western problem, but it is more prevalent here just because of our culture. You know, if you go to the Philippines, for example, girls really don't leave their parents' house until they get married. And or over in Korea, suicide rates are really high for people. You know, if they don't get into college or they don't get a good job, they commit suicide because they feel like they're not honoring their family name. You know, it's very common in Japan, Korea, suicide rates are very high because family honor is such a huge deal that if you were to get pulled over for a DUI, they might kill themselves because, like, oh, I've shamed my family. Whereas in the United States, you know, DUIs are, you know, pretty common. To get arrested is very common. Our stats here say that in your lifetime, one in four Americans will spend some type of jail time within their life. So it is a bit of a cultural thing, but that's not to say that it can't happen in those places, but it is less prevalent. But here in the West, it's sort of what makes and breaks us in the United States is that, or not just the United States, but just Western culture, is that we have this sort of experimentation. Whereas in some of these Asian countries, you know, they're very conservative. It's like, hey, you go to college, you get a good job, you get married, you go the safe route. And that makes for a very structured society, but it's also not very creative. It's also not very innovative. Whereas here in the United States, parents say, hey, as long as you're happy, you know, if you don't want to go to college, if you want to go run off and try to become an actor or a painter, good for you, as long as you're happy. And there's not a lot of conventional wisdom that used to be existent here. And I know that I'm younger than you guys, but a lot of this stuff happened in the 1960s. Going back to politics, even though there was always Democrat and Republican for the longest of time, if you go back to 1955, yes, there was racism and segregation. It wasn't perfect. But at least during that time, everyone sort of agreed that, you know, it's not good to have sex before marriage. It's not good to get divorced. It's not good to become a drug addict. It's good to work hard and earn your own keep. It's not good to be lazy and all these kind of things. There were sort of these core things that we as a culture sort of got behind: the Constitution, hard work, family values, all these kind of things. But then in the 1960s, we kind of just scraped all that to the side and said, free love, let's, you know, smoke some weed and do acid and just experiment. And then now we have 72 different genders. So
I thought we were up to triple figures now. Have they knocked some off?
Yeah, I think you're not up on the news. Yeah, I think we are in. Yeah, I think we're in triple digits.
It's at
now.
Least seven, 17 different genders for unicorns.
Going back to your point, why do young people go through this? Again, not trying to evangelize, even if you're atheist. There's a lot of great wisdom in the Bible that talks about this. The prodigal son, for example. All right, the story of the prodigal son. He wanted his father's inheritance, and he wanted to go run off to another country and sleep with prostitutes and go party. And once he lost all of his money, he came back home to his father. Or the book of Ecclesiastes in the Bible. King Solomon had over 700 wives. He was the richest man in all the land. But in the book of Ecclesiastes, he wrote that book when he was in old age. He was dying. He was losing all of his muscle. And all throughout that book in the Bible, he talks about vanity, 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 all is vanity. That's the whole recurring theme in the book of Ecclesiastes. Even if you're not a believer, everyone should read the book of Ecclesiastes. He doesn't even really talk about God that much in that book. It's really just about how you think that having all this sex, getting drunk, having money. He talks about this in this book, that he thought that having all those things would bring him to ultimate happiness. And whenever you're young, you know, whenever I was 20 years old, I had smoother skin. Now I'm starting to get, you know, some crow's feet. But whenever you're young, pleasure comes to you because you look better. You know, you're young and you're vibrant and all these things come to you. And you're like, well, I'll get my shit together when I'm 35 or 40. I have time. And it's easy to get away because everything is coming to you. But then once you're 35, you're 40, then suddenly people expect more of you. And then those consequences from what you did whenever you were 20 are now stuck with you. Maybe you're paying child support. Maybe you have a criminal record now. Maybe you have bad credit. And that all came from your wild living in your 20s. And then you're thinking, why didn't people tell me that there were long-term consequences? Because whenever you're young, you're basically Superman. If you break a bone, you're better in a week. And I really think that we need to sort of get back to the solution on how to fix racism and crime and all these things in America. And I have the solution for that. And the solution to that is to get behind a unifying principle. You know, we are a multicultural society. and everyone talks about diversity as strength, and you know, it is in many respects, but we don't talk about the weaknesses of it. You know, we have a Chinatown, we have Little Italy, we have a black neighborhood and a white neighborhood. We have all these different cultures and ways of thinking all living together on the same land. And all that extreme diversity creates all this division, and nobody can agree on everything. We used to stand behind the Constitution, and we used to stand behind at least some sort of idea of a higher power and family values. Now we can't even agree on that. We have 72 different genders. It's okay to sleep with as many people as you want. There's no consequences. You know, I want universal basic income. I want the government to, you know, give me everything. If I make a mistake, I want somebody else to fix it. All we talk about is what's owed to us, but this culture has shifted into what, you know, what are my responsibilities? What are my duties? And as I said earlier, a lot of that stems from lack of male leadership. 1 in 4 children are growing up without a father. We don't have that masculine sort of force in society anymore. And I think that's a huge part of it. But I will say this, is that it is important to a certain degree to sow your wild oats. And what do I mean by that? I know a lot of Koreans, you know, I have a lot of Korean and Chinese friends, and their parents are really hard on them. You have to study, you have to learn 5 different instruments, you know, and then by the time that they're 30, 35, 40, they are so repressed and they have all these regrets. And they're like, man, I really wish I kind of lived my life a little bit more. Whereas we have the opposite of we've lived our life and did all these crazy things, but now our lives are messes. So my advice to someone who's in their 20s, early 20s, yeah, go out, travel, live a little bit, make some mistakes, but don't make a mistake that's going to be permanent, if you know what I mean.
Right. No, that makes sense. So what's next for you? I mean, you've done all this stuff. So what's the next thing? What's the next thing on Randall's plan?
Well, I have 2 ideas that are floating around in my head right now. I'm going to give myself a 6-month sort of time limit. But I have 2 things that I've always wanted to do in my life that I haven't dipped my toes in, because I've pretty much did everything else. I even had a small acting career at one point, if you want to call it that, you know, doing some background work and being in some music videos and things. I've written books, I've competed in martial arts, I've done all these things, but there's 2 things that I haven't done. I've always been very, very interested, like I said, in theology, spirituality, you know, mentorship, all these kind of things. And even though I respect all of the great religions, you know, Buddhism, Taoism, you know, all these things, I'm a little bit biased towards, you know, Christianity. And that's what's been the foundation of my life. So I would like to spend some time traveling the world and doing some missionary work and just using my secular or my life wisdom and combining it with, you know, biblical wisdom and helping people who may be going through some of these issues or struggling through some of these issues that I've been through in my life. And sharing that with people anywhere I can go, even if it's just in the United States. But I love to travel, so I want to, you know, spread my wings, you know, very, very far. Secondly, if that's not something that I end up doing, I have lived a life of service. I've been a boxing coach to children. I've been a political activist. I've ran for office. I very much love to serve others, because it doesn't matter how much money that you make, you can't bring it with you when you die. And it's always much more impactful when you can share your blessings and your gifts and your talents with other people, and you can enrich their lives. So I'm 34 right now, and the age limit for the Army is 35. So that's something that I'm looking at also. So it's going to be one of those 2 things. And, I turned 35 on June 10th. So I'm going to spend the next 2 or 3 months sort of talking with family and spinning those gears in my mind.
Do you ever see a return to politics? Because, you know, you mentioned a little while ago about a unifying principle, what it's going to take to perhaps, you know, heal division, at least get people on the same page, even if they have certain differences over certain topics. But, you know, did you find originally when you ran that democracy, when you first start in politics, is an achievable goal, whereas the deeper you get in politics, you realize democracy is really a little bit of an illusion because you only choose from the choices presented in front of you? It's like going to Buffalo Wild Wings and feeling like sushi. Well, you know, you're only going to be able to choose off the menu items presented in front of you. And I think that's getting in politics more and more of a point where it's very difficult, unless you're being groomed to go into high-level politics, for regular people to break into it. But do you see yourself getting into any type of arm of politics where perhaps you can influence public policy rather than being kind of a puppet where you're not really allowed to put your own thoughts and feelings into it?
I was hoping you wouldn't ask me this question, but, you know, I don't shy away from anything, so... At some point in my life, if I'm still alive, because you never know what may happen, tomorrow is not promised. I make no illusions of that. One of my favorite quotes is from the great samurai, Miyamoto Musashi, where he said, the way of the warrior is the absolute acceptance of death. And I do accept my death. I've made peace with it. And that gives me great strength and bravery. I will run for president at some point in my life. I will go for that seat. And there may be some steps in between that. Maybe it's running for governor first, and it just depends on how much money I end up having in my war chest from here to now. If this video goes viral and gets, you know, 200,000 shares or something like that, I mean, God only knows, but I truly do feel that with the experiences that I already have and the experiences that I plan to have 10, 15 years from now, let's just say, you know, 15 years from now, you know, I'll be close to 50. I think that I'll be very well-rounded by that point. And I make no illusions. I really respect my elders. Anyone who's older than me, I automatically assume that they have something over me. That's just the way that I was raised. And I've been told that I'm wise beyond my years, but I make no illusions that I'm going to be, compared to what I am now, you know, 15 years into the future, I'm basically going to be a child in this interview. But yes, that is something that I'm going to do. And I do think that I already have the seeds of knowledge and experience that I'm planting into my future message and campaign that will be successful in unifying the country.
Nice. So, Randall, why don't you tell everybody how they can reach out to you, find out more about you, social media, all that good stuff.
Very simple. Just Google my name and you'll get hit in the face with pages of information. I have a Google panel that has my Twitter. It has most of the books that I've published. I have to reach out to Google. I think they're missing maybe one or two on there. But I've written, like I said, about philosophy, the legal system, theology. So there's a long category of topics waiting for you. So even if you don't agree with me on this pillar of information, that's fine. We don't have to be friends in every category. But I do believe that if you dig into me enough, you will find some interesting and useful things that you can take with you. And if that's the case, then I consider my life to be a success.
Very good. And I know exactly what you're saying, because him and I are definitely not friends on every category, because he likes to eat curry and that's terrible. But with all that said, thanks for tuning into this episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd. Randall, we certainly appreciate you taking some time out of your day to join us, and we will catch you on the next one.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Wolf and the Shepherd podcast. If you like what you just heard, we hope you'll pass along our web address, thewolfandtheshepherd.com, to your friends and colleagues. And please leave us a positive review on iTunes when you get a chance. Check us out on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for additional content. Join us next time for another episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd.